Recorded live in the Phantasmo Lounge, high atop the Gene Rayburn Building in beautiful downtown Chesapeake, it's Phantasmo After Dark with your host, Admiral Tony Mercer, Rob Floyd, and our special guest, Inspector Craig Eckridge.
Hi.
Our topic tonight, demons. Now, we mean actually the movie demons, not your own personal demons. We're not going to talk about those.
No.
We could go on for hours.
Your
about
drug
that.
Problem is your own business.
And there's other shows for that you can call into.
And I don't know if you noticed that Tony had gotten promoted since the last episode.
I noticed.
And I salute you, sir.
And I thank you.
You're welcome.
Carry on.
Now, our special guest tonight, Inspector Craig Eckridge, all the way from the wilds of the Richmond Outback.
The mean streets of Seafield, sir. The mean streets of Seafield.
That's right. An expert on tonight's topic, at least out of the three of us, maybe an expert. I don't know.
And how does one really get to be an expert in such a...
Well, you've watched it enough times.
You watched the shit out of it.
That's a good point right there.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about this little movie you love so much?
Well...
Okay, thanks. Now, Tony?
Yes.
If I have to say spoiler alert for a 30-year-old movie, you know, hey. I remember renting it from... It was an Errol's Video store. Did y'all have Errol's down here in Virginia?
Yeah.
Okay. Errol's Video, the first store that opened up that rented VHS tapes and what
and
all.
VSH tapes.
Too. VSH tapes, too. Sure.
They did that, yeah.
They had only had them in Baltimore.
It was between Beta and VHS.
And up until then... My horror fare had only been your traditional creature feature, Saturday, old Hammer, black and white stuff, or what was playing in the Metroplexes, the Friday the 13th and what have you.
All good stuff by its own.
All good stuff, but very pedestrian, more traditional fare.
Ooh.
And I'm flipping through and I'm looking for something to rent, and I remember it was the VHS art with just the green demon on front of it.
Okay.
And the big purple letters across the top, and something about that image, I'm like, this is tonight's winner, friends. And I watched it, and I remember thinking that I had never seen anything like it before then, because there was no guy in a mask. It was, you know, no power tools, no 50s Atomic, no Vincent Price, and very little logic to the goings-on. And that night, I remember having a very vivid dream about the movie. And I think that, more than anything else, is what sealed my affection for it, because that had never happened with anything I'd watched up until then.
Well, nothing that wasn't X-rated.
That's a whole different story.
Oh, okay.
That's a whole different story.
That'll be a different podcast. Continue.
And it just always stuck with me. And I wasn't sure why, and over the years I've watched it, you know, many, 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 many more times. And there's always somewhere else to go with it. So trying to figure out the backstory, I mean, was it Tony and I watched it a couple of weeks ago when he pointed out that the man in the beginning giving out tickets, brief plot synopsis if you haven't seen it, girl skips school, bumps into a guy with a creepy half-metal mask face, he's giving out tickets for a movie to the Metropole Cineplex. Various and sundry characters also get these free tickets, they show up, there's a prop of a demon mask on display. Rosemary, who I'm sure we'll get to later, tries to mask on, and hijinks ensues from there.
What did happen to Rosemary?
You're not asking the question correctly, sir. You're not asking the question correctly.
They did her ugly, I saw. I watched
So upon watching at the beginning, I realized that the man you see giving out the tickets to the passersby and whatnot, the half of his face that is metal... is the demon mask you see in the theater. What I never put together is there's a movie within the movie, of course, that they see.
Yeah.
And the guy in the movie who becomes possessed in the movie is the guy who's handing out the tickets in real world.
Oh.
And after years of watching this movie, I never point that together until the other week, the Admiral or the Viceroy or whatever his title is this year.
That's next podcast.
That's next podcast.
He's Admiral this week.
Pointed that out to me.
Yeah.
So there's also things, and then you can also, it's a great movie to throw one in the background when you just don't want to think about anything and just neon splashing across the television.
Motorcycles, silver demon mask, samurai swords, movie theaters.
And that movie will take you back to the 80s like very few other movies will, between the coloring, the hairstyle, the clothes, and the soundtrack.
And the bald pimp with the sideburns don't connect to any other hair.
Oh, with the Tony Manero outfit, the white suit with the dark shirt, and his spotted handkerchief. Tony the Pimp.
Tony the Pimp.
As essayed by one Bobby Rhodes. And the thing about that that's great is his dubbing in that film. And I don't know if it's the cultural acting style, or you touched on this when we went to the Guitar Wolf concert about how the Italians will dub the way they think they want characters to sound in America.
There's a long-standing tradition in Italian cinema of not shooting with live sound.
Yeah.
And there's a number of reasons for that, actually. One of them is that in most cases, they're going to dub the movie lots of different ways before it's released. International marketing is a very important thing in the, or at least was. And I'm not really clear on the current state of it, but at this time, this being the 80s and you know, going back into the 70s, 60s, 50s, international distribution was very important to the Italian film market. And they realized pretty early on that, one, the American market is important, and two, Americans don't like it. They don't like subtitles, and they don't like it when the lip movements don't match what they're hearing.
Yeah.
Right. So there's a lot of film markets out there internationally, which, you know, we ship Hollywood product to constantly, and they'll dub it, and so yeah, they're totally used to seeing lip movements that don't match the voices that they're hearing, and you know, they presumably don't give a damn, but Americans are biased, right, against such things. So what'll often happen on Italian shoots is that in order to facilitate the distribution of these movies into English-speaking markets, the cast will actually deliver their lines in English. Even the members of the cast that don't speak English will deliver their lines in English. They'll just learn them phonetically, so that when they are later dubbed into English, the lip movements will more or less match the words.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And oftentimes, those same actors will perform their own lines in the native Italian, and while the lip movements won't match, the original actor will in fact be performing the dialogue if they're Italian and they weren't brought in from elsewhere, which is also a thing that happens often. So for that reason, what, you know, why bother to shoot on live audio, especially when you've got half of your cast speaking in a language they don't actually speak phonetically, so it sounds terrible, right? Obviously. So they shoot these things with no live audio and dub them into any number of languages and release them that way. Depending on what movie you're talking about, who distributed it, and in what era, you might end up with a dub that is created by a U.S. company, or you might end up with a dub that was recorded by an Italian or some other European company where they just took whoever they could find that spoke English, regardless of their actual acting talent, and used their own opinions about what certain characters should actually sound like, and such things, you know, their own opinions about what, you know, those characters should sound like that are probably somewhat disconnected from the reality that we're used to.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And sometimes that produces wonderful, happy accidents like...
like?
Like Tony the Pimp.
Like Tony the Pimp.
And what does Tony the Pimp say, Craig?
Oh, Tony the Pimp says a lot, but the signature line is after Rosemary cuts herself and becomes infected, her cut starts bleeding again in the theater, and she goes to the bathroom to tend to her wound, and...
Is gone for quite a while.
For quite a while. And Tony casts his eyes about and utters the now famous, in this voice, "What the hell happened to Rosemary?"
That exact inflection and intonation.
Just like that. And this character vacillates back and forth in the movie between sounding like something out of TNT Jackson, who you legitimately believe could whoop the whole audience's ass. Between that and like a Mantan Moreland 30s, we got to get off the island.
Load it.
Another inflection that you will get in the movie is, "Shit, we got to get out of here." And it sounds just like that. So I think it's the same voice guy. I'm not sure, but I kind of hope that it is, because that guy needs some kind of an award.
I'm sure somewhere at some film festival he got his just due.
It's sort of like a blaxploitation voice performed by someone who's heard of blaxploitation but never actually seen one of the movies, and just sort of gives you his artist's interpretation of what he imagines a blaxploitation character would sound like.
That's a bunch of shit, baby. Now, wait, before we get off on that tangent, I want to go back to something you were saying a minute ago. about how they record the different soundtracks for different countries,
right,
and such like that. Now, I'm not as familiar with Italian cinema as you guys are, but I know in some of Paul Naschy's movies, Spanish films, where they reshoot entire scenes for distributions in different, like with nudity and then without the nudity, the same scene, with gore and with not so much gore. Do they do that in Italian films too, or not at all, or not as much?
There's probably some of that. There's not really much of it in the films that I'm particularly familiar with or interested in, not that I'm aware of anyway. I think for the Spanish films, that was a function of, you know, the era they were coming out.
Yeah, there's a lot more censorship in the film then.
Yeah, I mean, this is
in Spain,
at the tail end of Franco's Spain. And if I remember correctly, the increased nudity and the increased gore, that was actually for the international
market. The international releases, yeah.
The tamer versions were what was intended for release there in Spain.
Yeah.
And I think that is, again, a function of the conditions in Spain at that time.
Okay, that's what I was thinking. It was just mainly Spain, but I didn't know if, you know, they did that in Italy. I know the Mexican film market, specifically the Luchador film market, which will be another podcast entirely. They filmed a couple of those films, specifically is what I'm trying to say, one of the Santo films, El Santo, and the Dracula's Treasure, the Treasure of Dracula, was also called El Vampiro y Sexo,
yeah,
where they did inserts after the film was made of hardcore sex scenes,
yeah,
and nudity for distribution in foreign markets, which had nothing to do at all with the type of film that Santo was making at the time.
No, those Santo films, they were very much intended to be family fare, I think.
Yeah, and Saturday matinee movies.
Yeah, yeah.
And,
yeah. I'm pretty sure that, if I remember the story correctly, El Santo disowned that one that
yes.
they...
yes, he did.
And
he did not
buried.
Like that.
Yeah.
But I have the press book. Ooh. From when it was Vampiro y Sexo.
Vampiro y Sexo.
Y Sexo. But anyway, enough of that. Let's go back to demons, shall we?
That's a bunch of shit, baby.
Good a segue as any.
I've noticed, and you know, at length later, I want to talk about that Synapse release that they did, because that's just a beautiful, beautiful release of this movie. The steelbook, the art on the front, the Blu-ray transfer. And there are a few little scenes added here and there that don't add much overall to the plot. It doesn't change the function of the film. But even a shot of people walking through a crypt you didn't see before makes it feel like you're seeing an all-new movie that you've never seen.
Yeah.
When you've seen something for 25 years and it's like, oh, the Scooby Gang found a new path. And it turns into kind of a big deal. But when we were watching it the other week in preparation for the podcast, Tony couldn't remember what audio track you use, because there's the original Italian and there's two English tracks.
Okay.
And if you listen to the two English tracks when they did the release, 99.9% of the dialogue is the same, but there would be like one line that a character would say that they would change. It's like, why that line? It's just randomly.
What was the decision that went into...
Yeah, yeah, that line was unacceptable. It's like, how many ways can you say, you're a creep, Piggy, and then it's got to be something else. So
now, hey, let's get into the plot a little bit, because this is one of your favorite horror movies, Greg, all time.
It is, and what I tell people is, if you've never seen a European horror film, particularly an Italian horror film, the rule of thumb I've noticed over the years is, if the director or producer or whoever it is has an idea and they say, this scene is going to look great, it's going to be in the movie, whether it makes sense or not. Some people will have these big elaborate transformation scenes. Some will just, their hands will transform or...
But, oh, no, wait, before you get into that, let me sidetrack you again. Who made this movie? I don't think we said that at the beginning.
So it was produced by Dario Argento, who I believe co-wrote it. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
He's one of the co-writers.
Right. But it was directed by Lamberto Bava. And Lamberto Bava is, of course, the son of Mario Bava.
So you got a royal Italian movie lineage going here.
Right, right.
Now, the question I've always wondered, and that I've never asked a Europhile when it comes to horror movies, do you think there was a lot of cases at first, Tony, of people seeing Argento and Bava and being sucked into it without realizing that they weren't the director or it wasn't Mario, and then just being terribly, terribly disappointed with the product that they got?
Confused, maybe. I don't know about disappointed.
Well, I can speak to that directly, actually, because you know, that's how I came to it initially. I didn't see it, you know, back in the days when I wouldn't have known the Argento or Bava names, really. Not that I can recall, anyway. When I finally did see it, I was already into Italian horror and already a Dario Argento fan and a Mario Bava fan. So I sit down to watch it, and I guess this would have been in the years before the first DVD release. So it would have been, I guess, the Anchor Bay clamshell VHS. You know, I had high expectations for it, and I will confess that initially I was pretty disappointed. And it was more a case of what I was looking for based on the names attached to it,
mm-hmm.
than it was a case of, you know, sort of evaluating the movie on its own merits.
On its own merits, sure.
When you look at it as just the kind of fun splatter fest that it is, then it's great. And I don't want to jump the gun or steal your thunder, but you know, this does tie into what you were saying about the night and day difference between the recent Synapse Blu-ray and any other version that we'd seen. Because while I did eventually learn to love Demons for what it is, and not look for more in it than it needs to show you to be what it is, mm-hmm. just because, you know, Argento's name and Bava's names are on it. I remember I have the Alan Jones's Argento book from the UK.
Oh yes.
Yeah, great. That's a fantastic book.
And he loved the first Demons, and he praises it. He credits it with being an Argento film more than a Lamberto Bava film, and you know, you can debate that all day long. But you know, he talks about, you know, the candy colors and the visual presentation of it, and all these things that I frankly did not see. You know, certainly a little bit more in the DVD, but certainly not the first time I saw it on VHS. I mean, all of those colors that he talks about, and so much of that rich, you know, visual presentation is just kind of washed out and neutral in every home video release I'd seen prior to this new Synapse Blu-ray.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when I watched this new Blu-ray, I was like, okay, Alan Jones, you're not crazy. There it is. Because he reviewed it when he saw it in the theater originally,
yeah.
you know, back in the 80s. That's what he's talking about, is that you know, theatrical presentation. So he saw it in its
new and crisp.
You know, brand new and pristine.
Well, you know, that happened to us when we went to the drive-in a few years ago, sort of. And because we'd been used to seeing Vampire Lovers VHS, DVD, and I don't know if the Blu-ray had come out at this time. I don't think it had. But they had a brand new print struck for that drive-in that we went to. And we saw it, and it was that huge drive-in screen projected that far away. It was beautiful.
Yeah.
It was crisp. It was sharp. I'd never seen it that clean before.
Yeah.
So I can imagine, you know, what he was talking about, and then you seeing it on Blu-ray going, oh, there you go. Yeah. Okay.
Well, another thing that will also change the presentation and what I picked up from Demons is, I know that Robbie and the lovely Phyllis went to the Bird Theater when they showed Zombie.
Yes, we did.
Back in 2009.
Yes, we did.
The who was it? Was it Horror Hound Magazine? Or they had a deal where they were showing...
Yeah, they were. I think they were behind it, promoting it. Yeah.
The next film they showed was Demons.
Oh.
They showed that, and I went, of course, and saw it at the Bird Theater. So
you don't say.
I did.
You did.
And seeing that on the big screen, and I don't think it was necessarily a crisper print, but seeing it in the aspect ratio, full size,
uh-huh.
really added something else to it, well as, of course, the atmosphere. Because in the film, the ticket that they get to is to a huge, old, classic theater called the Metropole. And I looked it up online. Apparently, the Metropole, the real theater, was built in 1906. And it's one of those huge show houses with chandeliers and wooden seats and...
Kind of like the Bird.
Very much like the Bird.
Yeah.
In preparation for this podcast, sidetrack, I wanted to look up and see what the old Metropole was up to. And apparently now it's a gay bar called Goya. I guess, you know, the pilgrimage is canceled, but... But seeing that old... And this is... It's like a vast, expressionistic... It almost looks like something out of Metropolis or one of those kind of German expressionistic
films. The architecture's
wonderful.
So wait, let me get this straight. You went to this great old theater, the Bird Theater, to see a movie about people going to see a movie in a great big old theater that had a movie in it.
Yes.
About people and getting cursed by this demon mask. And then the people that were going to see the movie, you were going to see the movie of, the same thing happened to them in the movie you were watching. Okay, I just confused myself. Never mind.
Peeling layers of the onion, fellow. Peeling layers of the onion here. But yeah, it was, and it added something. So, but seeing it in the aspect, the full size, also would add, and where you would get to see things that you didn't notice before.
Oh,
in
yeah,
the presentation
definitely.
When, you know, the old, hell, it was still tube televisions when that thing first came out.
Yeah.
So, but
pan and scan, baby, pan and scan,
or cropping the black bars on the top and the bottom and call it widescreen. But you wanted a plot synopsis. So, as was stated before, two young girls decide to ditch school one night, and they come across this fellow, very punk looking. He almost looks like he has the same clothes that Arnold had in the original Terminator movie.
I was thinking some Destruction of Jared Sin look with that half metal mask. And okay, I'll go back and sit over here.
Metal Storm.
So he has these big gold tickets that say Metropole with the name of the theater on it, and he's walking through the subways and distributing said tickets, and they decide to go. And it's odd because in one scene, the girls show up and they say, "When did they open this place?" And it's like four stories tall. So it's not
and,
like they
and
threw
at least
this,
50 years old. And
you'd think that they threw this thing up overnight just to show this movie. And then you get a very atmospheric introduction to the theater. You see the house lights come on. And there's a dirt bike with a metal-studded ninja outfit with a samurai sword in one hand and the demon mask in the other.
And if that's not enough to draw you into the movie,
then you're listening to the wrong podcast.
That's right.
And the theater has the posters on the wall themselves are fantastic. There's one for Four Flies on Grey Velvet. There's a movie poster for the Klaus Kinski Nosferatu. There's an AC/DC poster on the wall. So it's just all.
Yeah, and in the middle of these movie posters, there's AC/DC.
There's an AC/DC
for the band
poster.
Or something. Tour poster. All righty.
So you get the various citizenry that have accepted these passes come in, and they're milling about, and you're introducing, and then you see the two male leads, and one of them has a very Dudikoffian vibe to him. he has a very Dudikoffian vibe to him.
Dudikoffian, we have coined an adjective there.
And is the film supposed to be set in Italy? Is that where it's supposed to take place?
I believe we determined last week that this film could be subtitled The American Ninja in Italian Germany. Because all the police cars say Polizei and all the street signs are in German, so it's American Ninja in Italian Germany is what we've determined.
Or Dudikoff goes west.
Dudikoff goes west. So they sit down and the house lights go down, and there's also there's the bickering couple. They've been married, and his idea of an anniversary present to his wife is to take her to a free film that he just got. Some punk rock freak gave him a ticket to.
He put a lot of thought into this anniversary. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a bunch of shit, baby.
And to also reference the dubbing vibe, the husband, whoever did his voice, is the voice actor that did the voice acting for Brian in Fulci's Zombie. So okay. I keep expecting to say, do we have to see this movie? Matul, that's not a cool place to head. I keep waiting for that line to come popping out of his mouth. And then there's the blind fellow with his, I think we determined it's his daughter.
Yeah.
Yes. For years, I couldn't determine if it was his.
I thought it was like his secretary or something.
After she's dead, later, he says something like, my child or my something. He says something that makes it clear that it was his kid, but that's not clear at all.
He's a slutty kid.
Especially since she refers to him as Werner the entire time.
Well, what really is clear in Italian Germany when it comes to relationships like that?
Relationships are complex in Italian Germany.
So you have Tony the Pimp with Rosemary. Do you remember the other?
You have three parental titles in Italian Germany: Mater, Pater, and Werner. What was your question again? I'm sorry.
Do you remember the name of the other lady of the evening who accompanied?
That was not Rosemary.
That was not Rosemary.
I can never remember her name because her name never gets spoken with the aplomb that Rosemary does. Because
nobody cares what happened to her. That's why.
But she was actually the better looking young lady.
Yeah, she was cute.
Well, yeah, but you know, nobody cares what happened.
She became a demon.
So, didn't everybody? But didn't everybody become a demon by the time it was
mostly? So as we walk in,
what else? What else is a demon?
An instrument of evil. Get it? So as we're introducing our characters, Werner touches the mask as he's feeling his way about because his sighted girlfriend slash daughter slash secretary can't be bothered to get him down the steps safely, apparently. And touches the mask and immediately recoils in horror and says, "Liz, don't touch it. It's evil."
And apparently Rosemary didn't hear that.
When we pan back, Rosemary has taken said mask and puts it on and is prancing about the lobby of the theater. And when she removes it, she cuts herself, prompting Tony to say, "That'll teach you to touch things." And he hangs the mask back on the leather-studded ninja hand. And we sit down, and American Dudikoff and his pixie-ish sidekick are on the make for our two female truants.
Okay. Now, wait a minute. But when they sit down and they start watching the movie, what's the movie that they're watching? What's going on in that? What's that about?
In the movie that they're watching,
because that's kind of almost kind of tells what's going to happen to them, right?
Yes, it's a bunch of young toughs who find a gravesite alleged to be that of Nostradamus.
Young toughs
on motorcycles.
That was Torres' favorite word.
Young toughs. So they find a crypt that is allegedly that of Nostradamus, famed soothsayer,
known to his friends as Mr. Know-It-All.
They go into the crypt and they find his tomb and they pry it open and there's a book, because of course there is. And a mask wrapped in cheesecloth, looking suspiciously like the mask we saw in the lobby of the film. One of said toughs puts the mask on, much as Rosemary did. When he takes off the mask, he cuts himself in the same area as Rosemary.
Coincidence? I think not.
At that point in time, Rosemary's cut begins to bleed, and she goes into the bathroom. While she's in there, the movie plays. The one prostitute looks at Tony and realizes, that's what just happened to Rosemary. Prompting Tony to say, that's a bunch of shit, baby. He then utters his famous line, wondering, where is Rosemary? And when the other young lady even goes to check on her, Rosemary has transformed into an instrument of evil.
Just like in the movie.
Get it? And we're off to the races from that point. The wheels come off the cart.
Okay, so from that point on, we don't see much of the movie they're watching after that, do we?
No, you see it. Little bits here and there, and what you see roughly parallels what's happening in the theater.
So, basically after that, Rosemary starts claiming victims, and they start claiming victims.
And they claim victims, and
demon to 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 demon. And they told two friends, and they told friends, and so on, and so on, and so on.
But the movie at points take these weird tangents, where you'll come to a part where they realize the demons are rampaging, a couple folks have already gotten killed in spectacular fashion, and the effects are great. I'm sure we'll touch on them in a minute.
Lots of gore in that.
They run to the front, they claw open the doors, and the doors have been walled shut. Why? Because, of course, they have.
Because demons.
And there's no explanations, it's never touched on again, it just happened.
Yeah, now that's one thing I was going to get at, is there's things like that just happen, they don't explain, you just go, okay, keep going with the movie. Because it's moving at such a clip, you don't. Mm-hmm. You kind of don't care. You want to know, but you kind of don't care. And then we get, they're trying to get out, and there's what? It gets down to two people left, right?
It gets down to two people left, but in the meantime, there's a randomly assorted group of punks who are driving around in a stolen car with a Coke can full of cocaine.
That's a Coca-Cola can.
It is a Coca-Cola can.
Full of cocaine.
Cocaine-a-cola.
Apparently, these homeless-looking punks have gathered together around $400,000 worth of cocaine. Because when it gets spilled, it just dusts the entirety of the inside of the car.
And these are very much 1980s low-budget movie street punks, by the way.
Yes. Was it Ripper and Baby Pig and just those kind of Death Wish Charles Bronson kind of punk names. And
straight out of a canon film.
And they decide they're going to break into the theater.
No. What happens is they get pulled over.
Oh, okay. That's right.
Get pulled over, and as they rough up the Italian Polizei, one of the demons coincidentally pops through a door that they happen to see open, so they enter the theater. So not only do we have our pool of victims become expanded because we've killed everybody up to this point. But now the contagion has seeped into the outside world.
Okay, and seep fast it does, because by the end of the movie, when the two break out, they, from what I remember, and I watched it not too long ago, but I haven't seen it quite as many times as you have. When they break out, this Jeep full of survivors, mm-hmm. who look like they've been on the road surviving and know all about these demons for, you know, months and months mm-hmm. and months.
Interesting enough,
take them in.
The little boy in the Jeep
yeah.
is the little boy from House by the Cemetery. So that kid's fine. He's good. Old school for this kid.
He has been on the road for years learning this stuff.
But we get the Battle of the Balcony, as I call it, where you get a little band of survivors that rip up seats and try to barricade the entrances. Works about as well as you would imagine.
Yeah.
But then you have the greatest 3 minutes of film history. When you're down to American Dudikoff from Italian Germany and his virginal love interest, Cheryl, the girl who took the initial ticket and started all this, by the way, but I'm not going to cast
blame. Thanks, Cheryl.
Oh, Cheryl. Cheryl was at her wit's end. They've gotten separated. They're running about. They're looking for rescue or what have you. Cheryl gets cornered, and all of a sudden, here comes Dudikoff on the dirt bike wielding the samurai sword.
In fine Dudikoffian fashion.
And at that point, accepts Fast as a Shark, bursts onto the soundtrack, and that will be the greatest 3 minutes of your life.
Now, where does the helicopter come in?
This has always been a point of contention.
Okay, wait, let's set it. They're in a enclosed movie theater with a bunch of demons. They're trying to get out, and all of a sudden, there's a helicopter.
Well, this is after Dudikoff has laid waste and done his little pose with the sword that he does. And you hear this noise, and a helicopter just drops through the roof of the theater. It just drops through the roof of the theater. And what I appreciate about this scene to this day is there's no CGI in 85. They dropped a helicopter through the roof of something.
A full-size helicopter. Blammo! Right and just, in the theater.
There it is. Just as bold as brass tacks. And that's always a point of contention with people, but it has always seemed to me that in the midst of the outbreak, whatever you want to call it, that they were transporting someone in the copter, or someone had become infected, and mid-flight did the Bill Cosby type thing and wrecked shop and led to the helicopter crash.
Or Argento or Lamberto?
Lamberto, yes.
Lamberto said, you know what would look cool?
I'll buy that as well.
If they drop the helicopter right through the roof in the middle of it.
I will buy that as well. Equally as acceptable.
That's right. I'm going with that.
And then, you know, we get to, they make their escape into the outside world.
All is going to be well.
Until part two.
Well, all is going to be well until, you know, he has to shoot a girl in the head this woman.
Spoiler alert, folks.
Oh, sorry. Spoiler alert. But yeah, it ends on a kind of a downer note that, mm-hmm. you know, they both don't make it. So if you haven't seen it, sorry. But, you know, you should have watched it. So anyway.
Which takes us at some point. You know, they did a Demons 2, of course, and then
Electric Boogaloo.
They ended up with Demons. They had Demons. The Church was supposed to be Demons 3. The film The Church
uh-huh.
was supposed to be Demons 3. And I remember reading somewhere that they were planning a trilogy that they were going to have movies and television and religion being the releaser of great ills into the world. And it was supposed to be metaphorical and have message
that. Well, isn't it?
That's another podcast. But then, of course, they did what they did in everyone. You got Black Demons, and I saw Demons 5, which it looks like it's somewhere in the Fortress of Solitude. It's some kids up in the Arctic on a skiing trip. It's just trickery. But Demons 2 is basically a shot-for-shot remake, and they chalk up the events of the first film to a sickness or a plague.
Okay.
Because why not?
Oh, okay.
Because why not? And that one is... Again, if you like the first one, there's things to enjoy in the second one, but it's almost shot-for-shot remake. They change a few. You get a demon dog in the second one, which is interesting to see. And you get a little demon thing. It looks like a ghoulie, actually, to tell you the truth.
But does Rosemary make it back?
Rosemary does not come back. However, Bobby Rhodes, who plays Tony the Pimp, does show up in Demons 2. Because Demons 2 is set in this high-rise, bulletproof, state-of-the-art security building, which, of course, backfires and locks everyone inside. And there's just a random group of weightlifters in the basement working out at all hours. And Tony the Pimp, the weightlifter, is the leader of this group of...
Of course he is.
Now, I told you I saw an interview with Bobby Rhodes on YouTube.
Yes.
A long one. And I was excited to see it because, you know, could it be possible that that was Bobby Rhodes' actual voice? And if it wasn't, what does Bobby Rhodes really sound like? So I hit play and I'm watching this video with much anticipation. And it turns out Bobby Rhodes speaks beautiful Italian. The entire... and nothing else. The entire interview.
Wow.
Yeah, he was subtitled. The interview was subtitled, thankfully. But yeah, that was bizarre.
And if we're going to talk about Rosemary, she's played by the beautiful Goretta Goretta. Also of, was it Bruno Mattei's Rats, The Knights of Terror?
Not to be confused with Robuta Labuta from...
And I've seen pictures of her lately, and she is still a very, very striking lady, still very beautiful. And for years I had liked this film and enjoyed it, and it was the lone voice in the wilderness, you know, singing the praises of this film that no one else had ever heard of or would admit hearing of. And back in, I want to say it was 06, there was a company called Bump in the Night Productions. And they did masks.
Oh, yeah, they did some good stuff.
They did props, and they did a full-size replica of the demon's mask.
Oh, yeah.
Which is an absolutely beautiful prop.
I remember when you got that.
So, I mean, that's...
And you've never put it on, have you?
And neither has anyone else who I've showed it to.
They're the same company that did the Brother Shock mask that we use.
They are. They are.
Hey, your cheek is bleeding.
That's a bunch of shit, Tony. But and they also did the Return of the Aliens, the Deadly Spawn prop.
Oh,
which I would love to have one of those,
man.
But that was the first real merchandise that I had seen from this film, or any real acknowledgement besides the DVD or the home video release. And then all of a sudden, a couple years later, I'm flipping through, I believe it was Horror Hound again, and there's a Rosemary bobblehead in mid transformation with the green. With the green Siloam light stick stuff coming out of her mouth. And I was... It literally stopped me in my tracks that randomly... And then the film...
A Rosemary bobblehead.
Exactly.
Now, wait, didn't they do a demon bobblehead with the silver mask face?
I think they did. Yeah. And then looking up the... they did a release... I think it was Arrow is the company, Tony, in the UK that does a lot of horror stuff.
Yeah.
They did one that had a small replica of the mask that came with it. And then they did a re-release a couple years ago that had a Chaz Ballin comic book that came with it.
Oh, that's cool.
So, and it's like the film's kind of had a resurgence. They did that showing at the Bird that I saw back, I think it was either 09 or 10. I think it was in 10.
And wasn't it one of the drive-ins in New York about a year or two ago?
Yes.
Well, they were showing it there, too.
Yes, they showed it as well. And... Was it a couple years ago? Was it IFC or AMC did the 100 greatest scenes in movie history in horror movies?
Something like that, yeah.
And it lasted all week. And the scene from Demons, the Rosemary change scene was mentioned. So it's the film kind of had a resurgence that I'm not really sure where it came from or how the film got rediscovered. But of course, I'm glad that it has. Because it has things to offer that I've literally never seen in any other movie.
Such as
the greatest 3 minutes in film history. And just the...
How does that stack up against the Zombie vs. Shark? To me, that's one of the greatest scenes in film history. And I know it is to you, too.
It was until I saw it in a commercial for Microsoft. At that point, I realized...
Separate yourself. Separate it.
Did that really happen?
It really did.
Oh, yeah.
I had no idea.
The commercial, it's a Microsoft commercial, and they're watching TV, and that scene is on TV. And then they go and talk to the camera, and the scene's in the background.
That's sad.
It's bizarre. It is. Bizarre.
It really is. It really is.
Still one of the greatest scenes in film history.
Mm-hmm. And then, was it last year, Synapse started promoting the Blu-ray re-release. Because it was the first presentation on Blu-ray, I believe, of the film. Had it come out on in a... in Europe on
Blu-ray? Arrow put it out in the UK, yeah. But their transfer doesn't come close to... Cinef did a full restoration on it, so...
And it had brand new artwork, and it's, you know, as I said, the steelbook, and it's beautiful. And it adds, again, you know, little scenes. Like, there's a scene that I'd never seen before, the punks kind of crawling through the movie theater, but it's catacombs underneath the theater.
Weird.
So little things like that were just...
Yeah.
A good bonus. And I had never understood, because in the rules of the film universe, you don't have to die. It can be a scratch. It can be a bite. It can be whatever it is to transfer. You can be bled on and the infection will pass.
Infection. Yeah, it's an infection.
Well, as American Dudikoff is zipping around on his motorbike...
He needs his own theme.
He really does. The leader of the punks, Ripper...
He has his own theme.
Ripper.
It always appeared to me that as he's driving, Ripper had grabbed a hold to him. And you hear American Dudikoff yell and scream and he starts bleeding. So you immediately think that's the end of him.
Yeah.
I didn't realize until the cleaned up Blu-ray that Ripper, his weapon of choice was a meat hook. And it was actually the meat hook that he got American Dudikoff with. But you couldn't see that before. The Blu-ray cleaned it up and it you know adds even plot points to it. So
if you get a chance to see it on Blu-ray, that's the way to go to kids.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and there was also one other thing that I found really interesting. I don't know if any of my colleagues here on tonight, Rob, I don't think you're much of a gamer.
No, not at all.
Okay. Tony, did you ever play Silent Hill?
I did not.
Okay. Well, in the original Silent Hill game, one of the good survival horror games that kind of birthed the genre. At the end of it, you're running around this old amusement park and you're trying to find the big bad at the end for the final showdown, so on and so forth. It basically turns into an abandoned town, and one of the landmarks you see as your character is exploring is you see the sign for the Metropole Theater.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the theater logo is actually in the town in this video game. That was a nice little shout-out, and of course, upped my appreciation for the game as well.
So what? No, okay. We've gone over the plot. We've gone over some of the merchandising, which is always, you know, fascinates me.
It's always fun. I mean,
what is it about this film that sets this above most others for you?
Well, this is one of the first films that kind of freaked me out later that night when I was thinking about it, because this was the first movie that I remember seeing where the big bad seemed like a legitimate threat. Because as you see in the film, when you get infected or turned or possessed or whatever word you want to use...
There's no coming back from that.
There's no coming back for it, but when the not-Rosemary prostitute gets transformed, I mean, it's a work of art. Sergio Stivaletti did the effects for
it. She's just been reduced to, is Rosemary and not Rosemary.
And not Rosemary. When not-Rosemary gets turned... The camera lingers on her transformation, and it's prosthetics and it's animatronics, but you actually see fangs pushing her teeth out, and you see claws pushing her fingernails out, and it legitimately, you can see the pain in this character as what's happening to the person, but you also see how this is not a person anymore, it's more of an animal. It's fangs, it's claws, and... Later on, there's a scene where they're coming up the stairs and you see glowing eyes and they run and they leap. And when she's transforming, she scrapes and you actually see her claws rammed into the wood of the theater.
Yeah.
So you see that these aren't people anymore and they're a lot more dangerous. So this is one of the first films where I was like, I don't know if I'd be okay in that situation. And that dream I mentioned before that was very vivid to me, I had never seen a movie before that had affected me and actually, for lack of a little better word, give me a bad dream when I was a kid. So that stuck with me as well.
You mean scared the bejesus out of you?
I'm pretty sure that's what I just said.
Oh, okay.
Well, you know,
that's called capsulation.
You mentioned how the demonism is essentially an infection and it spreads amongst the theater goers, and there's a small group of survivors within the theater that have to fight, well, to continue to survive against the tide of demons. And, you know, while this is not a zombie movie, it certainly is a cousin of a zombie movie, right? Just based on...
Oh, absolutely.
Based
absolutely.
On that description.
Yeah. I would think so.
So I wonder, I mean, you were wondering earlier, Craig, about the movie's growing cult and where it comes from. I wonder if that doesn't have a lot to do with it, because, you know, zombie movies are very much en vogue these days, and that's a very popular theme.
Yeah, and people are looking for different different avenues, takes on the zombie genre.
Right, if you're looking for something that's different but still recognizable as such, then you can't really beat Demons.
That's a very solid point.
Well, and like you said earlier too, Tony, it's a fun romp. You know, just cut the lights down, get some popcorn, sit back, and enjoy the ride.
Yeah,
it's not. Is it high art? No. Is it a fun damn movie to watch? Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
And no two transformations in the film are the same. It's legitimately,
I found kind of interesting.
It's legitimately one of those films where you're not, when someone gets cut, scratched, infected, whatever, you know that they're in trouble, but you're never sure what form it's going to take.
Yeah, each one turns into a different type of demon.
Exactly, and it affects them differently. And I wish they had explored a little bit more of the plot as to the backstory. Because not only are there scenes where you're wondering, as I mentioned, when they get to the door and the doors are bricked up.
Yeah.
Who bricked the doors up? You don't know. There's another scene later on where they're trying to find a way out, and they go into this little, just a brick side room.
Yeah.
And you get this almost Evil Dead presence in the woods, fisheye camera exploring in the room. And all the theater women characters start screaming, and the men are, oh, what's going on? And yeah. They never touch on it again, and it never happens again, and there's no explanation. And they get the idea somehow, and I forget where it comes from, that if they stop the movie, they'll be okay. So they bust into the...
That plot device has been reused in quite a few movies.
And they bust into the projection booth,
yeah,
and it's all computerized. And no one's there, no one's ever been there. And you have the creepy usher girl who casts knowing looks at all the characters, but then at the end she gets mashed up with the rest of everybody else as well.
So when they break into the projection room, Tony the Pimp is leading the charge, and when they find that there's no one running the film, there's only one thing to do. What's that, Craig?
Smash everything! Smash everything! And they do. But it never has a real explanation as to why or where or... But it goes back to the point you just made as, why do I love this film so much? In a way, I want those answers. But in a way, and this is going to be a leap, and I think Tony might actually hit me when I say this.
Oh, good. I want to see this.
You can kind of put this in the category of films like The Beyond or like House by the Cemetery, where bad things happen, and it's beyond the scope of human comprehension as to why. Who set these forces in motion? Yeah. Why is this happening?
It's almost like you start in the middle of a story that's been going on.
Yes.
You don't get a beginning. You just start at this point and go along for the ride. And if the movie moves at a good clip, if it's fun, you know, like Demons is, you kind of wonder those things, but it doesn't take you out of what's going on, out of the movie. You enjoy it and you accept it, and after a bit, you don't care anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, until you go back and talk about it later, like we're doing now.
Well, you made the point earlier, Craig, that that you sometimes got the feeling that if an Italian director thought something would look cool in a movie, it's going in the movie, and if it doesn't make sense. Well, there's a lot of truth to that. You know, you're absolutely right. I mean, these Italian horror movies, and to some extent European horror movies generally, tend to be very visual, and they're not so much dependent on narrative logic as they are dream logic a lot of the time. So if there's a creepy image in the mind of the filmmaker that they really want to, you know, get in there, they're going to get it in there. And if they have to get it in there at the cost of if there's no explanation for it and it's not really within the context of whatever the hell's going on, so be it. In a lot of cases.
Sure,
so.
Sure.
Okay, now let's go off on that tangent.
And in that regard, I'm sorry, Rob, but
go ahead.
You are, I don't know why you thought I wouldn't agree with this. On that regard, you're absolutely right that it does fit well with Fulci's quadrilogy, the Beyond and House by the Cemetery and whatnot. I mean, the Beyond what the hell is the plot of The Beyond exactly?
I don't know, but it only gets a star and a half.
I see what you did there.
But The Beyond is basically, I'm sure Fulci had an idea of what it was about, quote unquote, on his in his head, but mostly he just had a series of images that he wanted to get on film, and he, you know, sort of built a loose frame on which to hang them. But, you know, you're going to... And that might be, I think, one of the barriers for folks trying to get into the Italian horrors or the European horrors is, you know, you're going to react to that one of two ways. You're going to react to that as what you feel in response to this image. Are you going to react to it as it doesn't make sense and this pisses me off because it doesn't make sense? And that's sort of the dividing line between people who really like this stuff and people who really don't, I think.
Well, and some Italian directors take that to different limits, too, or different degrees. It's been a long time since I've seen Suspiria. Okay, and the first time or that I've sat down to watch it in a long time was a couple years ago, and I just couldn't get into it. It just didn't work for me.
I have to you know, join in on that. I love Suspiria, but the other Argento movie, Inferno, is very similar to that for me. It took me many, many tries before I could get into Inferno, and that's the next film in that series.
But see, now, this is what I was getting into, the different Italian directors. That's Argento. Okay, now you put a Fulci film in front of me.
Sure.
I enjoy Fulci, especially Zombie.
Mm-hmm.
Gates of Hell, the American release. City of the Dead?
City of the Living Dead.
City of the Living Dead. I actually saw that in a theater.
Wow.
Back when I was like 13 or 14. Now, like Fulci stuff, I can get into. It doesn't. To me, it doesn't have as much of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of a straight plot stuff. Bava, I enjoy. We've talked about that quite a bit, Tony. The artistic cinematography, the choices he makes, and all that. Where does Demons fall in within those three? Because they're distinctly different filmmakers in their style. Each one, you can almost tell if you didn't see who the director was, just the way the film moves, you can tell who's, and also the actors that they put in them. He's the same people over and over. But they have a feel to it. Demons, it's not an Argento film. It's not it's Umberto Bava, not Mario Bava.
Yeah.
But it's a different type of film than any of those, three styles.
I would say it's the furthest from a Fulci film, because Fulci films usually have, and I can't claim this thought for my own, but it crystallizes perfectly what I mean. Fulci's films have an overall impending sense of doom to them. I mean, Demons by no means ends on an up note, but there's just a certain level of darkness and despair you get in Fulci films that you don't find in Demons. I don't know if it's the candy colors or if it's the action.
Yeah.
But
the whole time, you think they're going to make it through.
Yeah, you think
at least somebody's going to might be a happy ending.
And even that, they also, in the Battle of the Balcony, as I call it, when they're fighting, it's a rout, but you never get the sense, just a feeling of doom that you get from Zombie or The Beyond. Because the scene in The Beyond when, at the end, when Liza and the doctor are fleeing the hotel and the lights come on and you start seeing the shadows go in front of the windows and the house you know is empty.
Okay, yeah.
At that point, you realize that not only, you realize that there is nowhere left for them to go.
Yeah.
That there is, that the gates of hell, to reference another Fulci film, are open, and there's nowhere left to go. There's nowhere left to run. Even though Demons ends on a down note, you get the kind of feeling there's a scrappy band of survivors. The grizzled old man in the Jeep is like, I saw lights in the west. Maybe there's still hope.
Yeah. Well, even the way it's paced and the way it's shot is nothing like a Fulci film. I don't think it's anything like a typical Argento film. Help me out here, Tony.
No, it's not anything like, pacing-wise, it's not anything like a typical Argento film. I mean, it's telling that, you know, Argento conceived of it and co-wrote it and he produced it, but he chose not to direct it himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I've probably read some comments from him in the past. There might even be some in the Alan Jones book that I referenced earlier as to why exactly He made that choice in his own words, although I don't remember what on earth it was now. But still, there's a lot to it infers a lot that he made the choice not to direct it himself, because it's not really typical of him. And I haven't seen a lot of Lamberto Bava's work, and outside of this, I've seen Macabre and a few other things. And by many accounts, there's not much to recommend much of his other work. Well, now, to be honest, though, he's done a lot of television work, and I think some of his most successful stuff has been for Italian television. We just don't really have access to that stuff. Mm-hmm. But
now, would you say, now, when did Demons come out? What year?
85.
Okay. I'm just, you know, spitballing here, shooting in the dark. Would you say Demons is an Italian take on American horror films? By the pacing and by the... It's more like almost an action-adventure pacing to it,
yeah.
The way it just moves the whole time.
Demons feels and looks very much like the Halloween episode of Miami Vice in some respects. with the color palette and the music that they use, I mean,
give us a rundown of the soundtrack.
You get Rick Springfield.
Not playing Jesse's Girl.
Motley Crue, Billy Idol, except... And then you get some new wave stuff, was it Go West?
And Saxon.
Saxon.
That's a lineup. Would you go see that concert?
Yes.
Yes, we would.
And who wouldn't?
We would. And it also, and as I was saying earlier, you know, kind of touched on, and this was, you know, a good bridge to that point, the Fulci horror builds slowly over the course of the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Once you get into Demons, you get past that first 15, 20 minutes of exposition.
And it's on then.
It's once the wheels come off, once Rosemary, you know.
Who?
Rosemary flips that That's in that bathroom, the wheels are off the cart. You may catch your breath little bits here and there, but it's all out. But you don't have that slow and inexorable build to just total doom and gloom that you would get in a Fulci film.
Yeah.
So, and also the... The choice of not only the soundtrack music from the artists, but the soundtrack that frequent Argento collaborator Claudio Simonetti provides to the film tells a story in its own. It's very...
The incidental music?
The incidental. Okay. It's very synthesizer and kind of pop.
Simonetti in his Art of Noise phase.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And
you said it would take you back right to the 80s.
It's just Moog synthesizers as far as the eye can see. And there's a fantastic video. We got to put the link up for the instrumental song that ties into the film.
Oh, definitely.
But that is also, as you were saying, it's very much a product of the 80s. It's not the atmospheric, slow, dreadful.
Well, I mean, you know, to be fair, almost all of the 80s American horror films are definitely products of the time, but there are a few that are just blatant about it. You know?
I don't remember there being any comments about Demons being modeled after any particular American movies or being done American style, nor do I remember any comments about it being directly at the American artist or at the American audience per se. I do seem to recall Argento saying that he had intended it to be a very commercial film, something that was just going to be a big crowd pleaser and get a lot of people in the door. And I think you're absolutely right, Rob. I think you nailed it. It's essentially an action-adventure movie to a certain extent, right? I mean, it's got a lot of, you know, it has some creepiness and some nice horror touches and some of that cool Italian horror dream logic stuff that we talked about. But in a lot of ways, it's sort of this rock and roll action horror romp, really.
It is. It
Motorcycles,
it really is.
Demon meth, sword, helicopter. That's all I'm saying.
Out. Yeah, and... And there's not an overarching evil to defeat. Can we find the talisman? Can we slay the wizard?
Yeah.
Survive.
There's not that impending feeling of doom because it's moving too fast. You're stuck in the moment the whole time.
Exactly. It's kind of hard to feel an impending sense of doom when one of your male leads has a forest green sweater tied around his polo shirt.
We'll call him Skip, shall we?
We'll call him Skip.
I wonder if Evil Dead could have been an influence.
That's a good point because I've always that scene we were talking about earlier, where they're looking for the way out and they go into that little brick room that's dripping water, you get a very fisheye kind of probing Evil Dead.
Raimi-esque.
Yeah, a Raimi-esque, you know, unseen force.
Yeah.
View from something that's creeping about.
And they never do it again.
And you never see it again.
Yeah. They tried it one day. Didn't like it.
And they didn't like it.
Cut, print, keep moving.
So, but yeah, I mean, it's just overall a fun film. It's a great film to how you can put it on in the background or see something out of the corner of your eye, an image that will just grab you and pull you back in. And you can just have a lot of fun with it. Now, you don't have to overanalyze or...
Yeah, now would each of you, would you say that somebody who's not familiar with Italian horror, maybe hasn't seen Fulci, hasn't seen Bava, Argento... Would this be a good one to break somebody in, or for them to get a taste of their first Italian horror film to get into the?
Good question. This is actually one of the films when I have a lot of friends at work who are somewhat interested in horror, and they know that I've seen a lot of stuff that they haven't or what have you, and they're curious about it, and they say, hey, what do you have? This is one of the film. This is my gateway Italian horror film
for them. This is how to separate the men from the boys.
Yes, because, and I give them the warning up front. I said, there are scenes in this film that you're not going to be sure why this happens or why this is different from that.
Just go with it.
I always tell them, I said, don't ask me because I don't know either, and I've been watching this movie for 30 years. It just is. And if they can take this movie and have fun with it and go on, then I'll introduce, you know, something like The Beyond or something else that's a bit more, you know, as Tony called it, the nightmare logic, where things make even less sense.
Yeah.
I think this is a good gateway film because if you can just totally blank on two or three scenes as why this or why that, it's a very straightforward, as Tony called it, it's a zombie film. X happens, there's infection, we yeah. gotta live through it. It's very stripped down in some respects.
How about you, Admiral? What do you think?
That's a tough one for me. There was a time when I would have said no to that question.
Okay.
That I think... something like a Suspiria is probably a better introduction.
Go ahead.
Well, only because Suspiria, your experience with it notwithstanding, Rob, I think Suspiria is a pretty easy one.
Okay.
For newcomers, for the most part. It's very effective. It's very creepy. It asks of you some concessions that you'll have to make very common or very often with these kinds of movies, but not to the extent that an Inferno does, for example. But its pacing and atmosphere is, for the most part, a little more typical. And I hate to put it this way because it makes it sound like the movie isn't special and isn't unique when it is, but its pacing is a little more typical of what you can expect for these things, whereas Demons isn't. Obviously, we already talked about how it's sort of this fast-paced, action adventure rock and roll thing.
Fair enough.
Right?
Okay.
So if you're going into Italian horror looking for more of that, you can find it, but in that very limited sphere, or I hesitate to call it subgenre, but amongst those movies from that time where you can find something similar, the quality drop off from something like Demons.
Oh yeah.
To,
okay.
Oh, God, help me out here, Craig.
Zombie 3?
Demons 3?
or Hell of the Living Dead and things like that. I mean, the quality drop-off is steep, man. It's huge.
Yeah, okay. Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Right on.
Whereas I think it's much easier to segue from a Suspiria to a Beyond or into the Giallos, into Deep Red and stuff like that.
I've never lent Demons to anybody. I've had people say that they didn't care for it. But I've never had anybody tell me that either A, it was bad, or that they were bored by it. Now, if you lend something like Burial Ground to somebody, you're going to get some pretty strong feedback on that one.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, as I said, in the past, I would have said no, and for those reasons that I explained. But now, with, the zombie craze being what it is, and so many people being interested in that, then Demons might very well be a good intro, because it's enough of that sort of familiar tropes from the zombie movies that it'll sort of ground it for those folks. But it'll, if they really enjoy it, it'll help them kind of ease into the whole, even though the lip movements obviously match what you're hearing, it's also obviously dubbed.
Yeah.
Which is this weird sort of disconnect in these movies that, you know, it takes a little getting used to for folks. It's kind of disorienting, you know, that and the logical gaps and the, you know, if it looks cool, hell with it, if it doesn't make sense element of it. I think the combination of those things you're going to get used to for, or have to get used to for the Italian movies, but here's some familiar zombie tropes and lots of fun stuff going on. It might very well make it a great package for introducing people to Italian horror nowadays.
Now, would you, how would you say that against Fulci Zombie, as far as that being a gateway film, a lead-in?
Probably an even better example of one than Demons, I suppose. I mean, if somebody's coming off of...
That's what I always say. Yeah. Anybody asks about tie-in, I say, well, start with Zombie, because you can't beat Captain Haggerty.
No, especially if you're coming to it from the Romero films. You know, you're already down with that sort of pacing and tone of a zombie movie, then you're in for a treat with Fulci's Zombie. So.
But you also have to, I think, take into account who is the person who's asking you, what do you have to see?
Yeah, well, I'm talking because about just the general uninformed.
I think now, with the world being what it is and the state of the genre, I would go more with a zombie.
A straight-up zombie. Like
Fulci Zombie. Fulci that's what I mean. I would go more with zombie as a gateway because those tropes are so entrenched at this point.
Yeah.
And you can suss out, if you choose to, you can suss out, quote-unquote, a reason as to why this is happening on the island.
And zombie versus shark. That's all I'm saying.
Demons, I think you would ask people to make more leaps to assume more things.
Yeah.
And I don't know if, as a gateway, they'd be willing to do that right away or necessarily make those leaps. I think zombie would be a better gateway drug.
Now, wait, here's a thought I was saying just a minute ago. I was talking about comparing it to American horror films, like being an Italian version. And it kind of struck me that it, I don't want to say it has a vibe, but if you're talking American horror films of that era, you know, you got the Friday the 13th, you got the Halloweens, but it leans more towards a Nightmare on Elm Street, a Freddy kind of, you got, you know, wild colors, you got outrageous stuff going on coming out of nowhere.
Well, you know what?
But it has nothing to do with that at all. I don't want to suggest that.
The American film that this always seems to me makes a good double feature is Return of the Living Dead. Because you get
there
you get that kind of punky, you get the carload of punks and you get that kind of vibe. The music's very similar. But also the nature of the threats, the demons in Demons, of course, and the zombies in Return of the Living Dead, they're smart, they're fast, there's a legitimate sense of menace to them.
Okay.
And to me, that's always made a good companion double feature. They're very similar structure.
Word, homie.
Tony's done. Tony's got nothing else.
Start working blue, kid.
You're covering the ground, baby. You're taking care of business. Mm-hmm. I got nothing to add.
Well, I did want to throw back to one thing earlier. It was I wasn't sure if, you know, necessarily saying that you were going to hit me or if anyone else ever on the in the history of humankind has lumped in demons with the work of a Fulci or a Dario Argento. They're high water marks in the genre.
Well, you have to lump it in with the Argento because he worked on the thing. But no, I totally got your point with the Fulci comparison. Rob's point that Fulci movies make more logical sense than Suspiria, that's highly friggin' questionable.
Well, I'm not saying they make more sense.
Have you seen The Beyond, for Pete's sake?
Don't worry, it's only worth a star and a half.
Yeah, it's only worth a star and a half, yeah. You know, I'm just saying, as seeing Zombie a few more times, I guess, and seeing Suspiria.
Well, Zombie's a totally different kind of thing than Suspiria is meant to be. You know, Suspiria is a dark fairy tale.
Very much, yes.
And Zombie's a, you know, zombie movie, so.
Yes.
Well, there you have
it. We go to an island and they want to eat us.
And Captain Haggerty.
Also Haggerty.
Now, let's go back a minute and talk about the different releases of it. The newest release that's out that's available is that Blu-ray you were talking about.
It's the Synapse Blu-ray. Highly recommended. Highly recommend.
You know, they put it out as a limited edition steelbook that you have to order off their website, and it was pretty expensive. So that's, you know, that's for existing fans and diehards only.
Well, I did see that Dan has posted on Facebook that they're doing regular releases of them now.
They are. They're coming out soon, if not already. I think they were coming out just after Halloween.
Oh, okay. So you get the high quality.
You do,
right? You don't get all the language options, and I think it's missing some of the extras, and you don't get the fancy packaging, but you get that great transfer. So
you can see it like you've never seen it before.
You can see it like you've never seen it before.
See it again for the very first time.
In a world.
I think that's probably just as good a note to end on as any.
And probably better than most.
any parting thoughts? Anything anybody wants to add on that? Or you want to go for another hour? Whatever you guys want to do.
That's a bunch of shit, baby.
it's one of those films that I've used it as a gateway when people say, what do you have that I haven't seen before? This is one of my go-tos. I've had very few people say that they don't like it. And amongst horror fans that I know, the more dedicated horror fans, I don't know anybody in that subset of my friends that don't like it.
All right. That's a good testimonial.
It is. Yeah. You know, and you said something important right there. People asked you, what have you got that I haven't seen before? And that's what it all comes down to for me. You know, that's why I love these European horror films so much, but largely because they're far more concerned with impactful imagery than they are with linear narrative or, you know, sort of procedural narrative. Thousands upon thousands of movies tell very clear linear beat-by-beat stories. But a lot of these Italian films contain images that you will not ever see anywhere else. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's what it's all about.
And I'll even take that, and that's, you know, a great point. Even if you take a film like A Nightmare on Elm Street that deals in dream logic, or are there any other American films you can think of offhand that kind of have that rubber reality feel to
Jacob's Ladder.
Even in American films like that, you don't get imagery like you get in European films. Sir?
Phantasm.
Phantasm is very much sort of an American take on a European horror film.
It gets to points where you're not sure if it's dream or if it's the reality.
Yeah.
And even right up till the very end, and then the next film, you're like, well, wait a minute.
Even the soundtrack of Phantasm is reminiscent of like a Goblin
soundtrack. It really is.
It's a great soundtrack. That will be a total different podcast because I love me some Phantasm. Yeah, I do.
Phantasm is a very European-American horror film from Italian Germany.
Sans Italian ninjas. Germany. Well, Reggie.
Reggie.
But that's more in the sequels.
There you go.
Alrighty. Are we by it at the end?
I just want to let the audience know.
I was going to say, there's a few things we had to tag Rob's, on.
That Rob's father-in-law looks just like Reggie Bannister from the Phantasm movies.
He does. And he's probably got as many shotguns. But he doesn't have a Hemi Cuda, unfortunately.
That's all I wanted to say.
But now, since we've come to the end, hey, if you've been listening and you like what you heard or you don't like what you've heard, tell us. We'd love to hear it. Go to the Phantasmo After Dark Facebook page. We'll be posting the trailer for Demons and some pictures from the movie, some other odds and ends we've talked about here. And we welcome your comments, good, bad, indifferent. And if there's anything you'd like us to, you know, talk about, please tell us there. Or you could email us at
phantasmopod@gmail.com. That's phantasmopod@gmail.com.
MOUSE.
Why? Because we like you.
And there you have it. Episode 4, isn't it?
Episode 4.
Wow. And thanks to everybody that has been listening. We really appreciate it, and yeah, that's about all I got to say.
Say goodnight, Gracie.
Goodnight, Gracie.